At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
What up? It's the Crossover Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today, one of my favorite people in the business. He's an author, producer, commentator, all kinds of other things. He is Howard Bryant, my fellow HB. You know his work from ESPN. He's a correspondent for NPR. He's working on his 9th book. It's going to be about Ricky Henderson. Can't wait for that one. He's the co-executive producer on Bob Costas's new HBO show called Back on the Record. And he's got a new gig with Dan Le Batard's new media company, Meadowlark, where he's going to be doing film and documentaries. If you know Howard Bryant's work, you know he writes extensively on the intersection of sports and society, politics, social issues, race. His last book, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field, went into a lot of that, as several of his books have. And I felt like this was an opportune time to bring Howard Bryant on the podcast. We, of course, recently passed the one-year mark since the George Floyd killing and all that came in its wake, including a lot of athlete activism, obviously a lot of NBA player activism that dominated last summer. And so here we are a year later. Where are we today? Was that a movement or was it just a moment? We also discussed the recent wave of fan misconduct, the bottle throwing, popcorn throwing, spitting, racial epithets. Where is it all coming from? Howard Bryant's got a theory on it, one that I don't know that you've heard before. And it was very interesting. Great discussion on that as well. And on the basketball side, he's a little concerned for the game itself, and he's a longtime NBA fan, so I always listen when Howard Bryant's got some observations about the state of the game. Before we get to that, a reminder, please subscribe, rate, and review the Crossover Pod on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Hit me with any feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck, and you can find Howard Bryant on Twitter, at HBryant42. Okay, really fascinating discussion on the NBA, race, activism, and the state of the game with Howard Bryant coming up, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined by, I'm pretty sure, the only other Howard that I've interviewed on this podcast or any other podcast that I've been part of. Howard Bryant, welcome.
How are you? Good. Same initials, too. It's not just the Howard. It's the HB to the HB. That is
yes, it's
the
HB squared.
That's right.
I won't say it's unprecedented because we did this on my last podcast at a previous stop.
With Harrison Barnes?
But Harrison Barnes, I did have Harrison Barnes on the last podcast too, so I've actually had two HBs, right. But you were the only other Howard.
Exactly. Well, and I need to stop you right there, Howard, because before we got on, we talked about, I was asking you why was Larry Bird trending and there was a little bit of a streak of doom, like what's happening? It's nothing. It was the fact that Larry Fitzgerald was at the Suns game the other night and ESPN said, Larry Legend. The caption said Larry Legend watching the Suns. I'm like, there's only one Larry Legend. Hey, mad respect to Larry Fitzgerald, but there is one Larry Legend and it's Larry Bird. Sorry.
And somehow that got Larry Bird trending?
Yes, because somebody subtweeted that or quote tweeted it and said, I don't see Larry Bird in this picture. And there you go. That's all it takes for you to trend. That's all it takes.
That's all it takes. And it's all it takes for all of us who have been in this business a while to get nervous about, like, what's wrong? Is he okay?
Especially in these last 15 months.
Yeah, you know, take nothing for granted. We're both glad to hear that Larry Bird is just fine and is still a legend. Thank you for coming on. Before we jump into it, you've got a new gig with Meadowlark. That's Dan Le Batard's cool new media company that is expanding by the day and hiring all the best people in the business, it feels like.
You're on a board, Howard. You're on a train.
I just did that thing. I gotta hang
on. Am I going to get a letter for tampering? Am I going to get fined for tampering right there?
Adam Silver does not approve. Just ask Daryl Morey. It doesn't take much. Just any playful little tweets, and the next
come
thing
join.
You know, I was on a podcast recently with your now colleague Stu Gatz.
Yes,
was kind enough to have me on his podcast, in which he actually threw at me all right, so who are the five greatest Howards of all time, or it was like named like the five best, and like that was tough. Like that was a tough exercise, and it actually got me thinking. Like, there's no Howards. There are very few Howards in the NBA, at least modern NBA, right? Like, you have to cheat. Like, it's Dwight Howard, Josh Howard, Juwan Howard, but like Howard Isley back in the day, and then you have to go way back. There's a lot of Howards and Howies in the 60s and 70s.
Howie Evans, Temple University, man. But he never even made the NBA.
I didn't like any of the options that Stu got, or very few of them that he threw at me to name the best Howards. So who would I'm not going to demand five. Like, who are your top three Howards of our lifetimes?
You.
Don't pander to the host.
Of our lifetimes, you got to go. I'm always in horrible shape on that, because with my name, you've got Dwight Howard and Kobe Bryant, and they ended up being teammates. So I'm like not even on the Google search, right? So that just killed me. The best Howards. Well, you know, if you wanted to go coaching, you got to go the Howard Schnellenbergers. You got to do there for the, Louisville, Miami, the U there. But he's not a favorite of mine. I don't even like college football. Howard.
Doesn't have to be sports. This was broad, all of pop culture basically, or all of society. So, you know, he was throwing at me. He even went to Howard the Duck, which just killed
that.
Me.
Like, I used to get that in grade school. And I used to get Howard the Duck.
That was not a good time for you and me.
I didn't love that. I did not love that.
Yeah.
Gotta like the DJ Howie T back in the day. But there's not that many.
Yeah. No, it was like Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell, who didn't love that.
You did not want to be associated with. Now he's just considered like a legend, but back then everybody hated him. And Howard Cunningham from Happy Days.
From Happy Days, yes, know? Tom Bosley, yeah. It's just not, it's a barren wasteland.
It's a barren wasteland. Well, so my thing is this, and then we'll move on. I said that when Howie Long came along, playing for the Raiders, and he was this big, bad, muscular dude,
exactly,
flattening people, helps. I'm like, there we go. Somebody has finally like validated my name in a way, like a person who's famous, who shares my name, who is not like
an accountant.
Yeah. Right.
Howie Long helped Howies everywhere.
He did. Shortly after that I started going by Howie more than Howard. Although I've since in my professional life switched back.
He legitimized Howie.
Do you know that on your Wikipedia page, it says Howard, quote, Howie Bryant?
I'm sure it does. Whoever mangled that page, I'm sure they were taking their shots. Anyone who calls me Howie either knew me from the eighth grade or took a shot and got away with it.
Yeah.
Like Susan Slusser, Brian Murphy, they call me. They're the only people, I think, in the business who call me Howie. And I don't know why. They just did, and there was no sanction.
No, it's my college crew that calls me Howie, and then anybody who wants to try to annoy me on Twitter or whatever else, because they think it's demeaning somehow. It's a way to which is weird.
No, the college group too. You're right. College folks still do that too.
Moving on. Before we started recording, you were speaking, and I was, I don't know if I was shocked, concerned, but you were speaking of possibly sitting out the rest of these NBA playoffs. You did not say why. I thought we'd wait till I started recording so that I could be either surprised, appalled, horrified, concerned. I don't know what it's going to be. Why are you going to sit out the NBA?
Well, what I'm really looking for from you, Howie, I'm looking for support. I'm looking for your support. I'm thinking that this could be a therapy session
for me. I can do that.
All right. I'm interested in your feelings on this. I don't know if you're in the same boat. I had a revelation. I've had the you know, these past, you know, pandemic months have, I guess, created some introspection even beyond what we usually do. And so in baseball last year, I had the revelation, of course, when Kevin Cash took Blake Snell out of an elimination game after throwing under 80 pitches. What did he throw? 75 pitches, 70, whatever he threw. And I realized that all this stuff that we're watching now runs counter to the reason why I watch. I realized that I don't watch baseball for wins and losses. I watch baseball for competition. I watch to see your best against my best. I want to see if Blake Snell can go through the lineup. I don't want to see some, you know, the analytics say that, okay, we need 12 pitchers to get 27 outs. And if that's how you do it, then that's how you do it. I watch competition. I want to see Bob Gibson. I want to see, you know, Jack Morris pitch, you know, 10 innings. So this was big for me, trying to understand that this is the reason why I'm having so many problems with the way the game is going. And then basketball, you know, it's easy to just say, well, the game's unwatchable because there's just too many threes or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, this is not how you know, you grow up. I mean, I remember having this conversation in the early 90s. I remember saying, I think it was Bulls Blazers. And you're looking at guys like Pippen, and you're looking at guys like Clifford Robinson, and you're like, you know, I was like, look, in 10 years, there's only going to be two positions in the NBA. There's going to be the tallest guy, and there's going to be the shortest guy. Everybody else is going to be pretty much interchangeable. And that ended up happening, right? For the most part, the skill sets of these guys, everybody's pretty much between 6'5 and 6'9 or 6'11, and they can all pretty much do what they do, right? So it's not like you're yelling at the clouds. It's not like, okay, if you've been watching basketball all this time, it's not like, oh my God, I can't deal with the fact that these guys are, you know, taking 27 threes, 37, 45 threes a game. But the revelation, Howard, was this. I realized that the thing that I loved about watching basketball is it's a game. It used to be a game of makes. Like when you watch basketball, when you grow up playing basketball, the very first thing you had to do as an offensive player was you had to make half your shots. You know, it's a game of makes. It's a game where the ball is supposed to go into the basket, right? You're supposed to make half your shots. You're supposed to make 80% of your free throws. I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, Dennis Johnson was considered a bad shooter. He only shot 44% from the field. It's pretty good today, right? That's actually not that bad. So what I'm watching now is I'm realizing that this is not a game of makes. It's a game of misses. And so when you go out there, the Utah Jazz averaged 43 threes a game. They only took 88 shots for the night. So half their shots are three-point attempts, right? So you're watching more misses than ever. And I'm having real problems watching this because I remember going in and watching the games. And I remember, you know, Alex English, the guys who, even guys who were high volume shooters were still making 50% of their shots. Dr. J made 50% of his shots, right? I mean, Andrew Toney, one of the biggest gunners in the game, he was shooting 52% from the field. So today I'm having to really get used to the fact that you can watch a game and guys come right down the floor and just miss a ton of shots. But the way that the analytics support the idea of efficiency, they're not looking at it in terms of missed shots. They're looking at it in terms of threes versus twos, right? Yeah. You got to shoot X percentage by two to make up for the extra point. And that's just not the way I'm used to watching basketball. I have to either decide that I'm going to get comfortable that it's a game of misses now and not a game of makes, or I'm going to have to say goodbye, man.
Wow. Wow. So this is fascinating on a couple different levels. One is that, you know, this is in some respects, the common complaint or critique of the modern NBA, especially by people of our generation or older, who grew up on a very different looking game, right? Post-ups, and the three is a last resort. It's not the go-to weapon, all of this. And so people have criticized that from various vantage points, but I've never heard it actually framed the way that you did, which is that we now accept that the overall field goal percentage is going to be lower because we're fixated on effective field goal percentage, which accounts for the extra point of the three-pointer. And so, okay, as long as you make it, and it all makes sense from a, you know, mathematical standpoint, from a competition standpoint, but you're right. We have to readjust our expectations in that what used to be considered a good field goal percentage. Well, no. Now you got to parse it out. Separate his twos from his threes. Because if you're shooting a lot of threes and a good three-point percentage is 40, like anything 36 to 38 is pretty good. 39 is great. 40 on up is spectacular. But we grew up on an understanding of, no. You want to make half your shots overall. Yeah. Not to say nothing of where you shot them from or what they were worth. So you're right. Like, I hadn't really thought of it about being about the miss instead of the make, or that we're accepting of a lower overall field goal percentage. But that's a different thing than the aesthetic critique that people have made of just, I don't like seeing guys jack up a bunch of threes, or I don't like seeing.
Yeah, for me, it ends up being something of the same thing. The aesthetics of a lot of misses, it's an ugly-ass game, right? However, I will say one thing about this, one little piece where I make a distinction of our generation. I am not a fan. I would watch today's basketball way more than watching 90s Knicks, Bulls, Pacers. I don't want to see some 73-69 game. I did not find that to be enjoyable at all. I didn't look at that and go, oh, that's real basketball where these guys mugged each other. And it was, you know, and you ran the triangle and you just smothered each other. I didn't find that to be compelling basketball either. To me, I sort of, 80s basketball is very different from 90s basketball.
Yes.
Which is very different from 2000s basketball, which is very different from teens basketball. Right. So it's not like you're yelling at the clouds, you know, really, really pining for John Starks to go, you know, 2 for 18 or whatever in an elimination game. It's more, am I shorting him a shot? Did he go 3 for 18?
I think it was 2 for 18, wasn't it?
2 for 18. Yeah. I'd had it right the first time. Yeah. So it is an aesthetic question, but it's also, you know, and you also have to sort of recalibrate the result of that. Like, okay, there's a reason why Russell Westbrook and Rajon Rondo get more triple doubles than ever. They play long rebounds. So guards are going to get more rebounds than ever today as well. It's just a different sport. And I think that, to me, when I watch basketball, especially playoff basketball to me is all about possessions. It's always been about possessions. But the way the game is played now, you have to totally recalibrate, you know, your thinking to conform to what you're watching.
I think that's all obviously fair. And I do think, like, obviously so much of this is about personal taste, era that you grew up in, what you're used to seeing. All of that is true. But I also think that, you know, to your one of your first lines of critique there about 2 through 4 in the lineup now being interchangeable, like that's one of the it's one of the positive developments of the game in a lot of ways, right? There's so much skill out there. We just had the MVP is now a 7-foot center who looks physically like centers of yesteryear, this big physical specimen, but who does all this guard stuff, and we have more skill across 1 through 5 than the game has probably ever had.
No argument there.
And so, you know, look, the aesthetics of the game, if you, it may be hard to take this out, but take out the explosion of the three-pointer. The fact is, the skill set, the athleticism, there's so much to be entertained or engrossed by. Every time Dame pulls up near the logo, and there was a time when, if that happened when you and I were watching in the 90s or the early 2000s, everybody would be apoplectic. A coach would have been losing his mind.
Out of the game. Exactly. You'd get taken out of the game, or you knew that it was the last shot of the quarter. It was the only time you ever took a shot from
now, there. Now it's one of the most exciting moments in the game. Oh my God, Dame's going to do it. He's pulling up, and you're pretty sure he's going to hit it because he's freaking Dame. And Trey is doing it, and Steph is doing it. And so I just think there's different aspects of the game that still make it engrossing, but is stylistically very, very different. So I don't know I don't know what the answer there is. And I do know that this much, there are people around the NBA who are worried about where does this go? Where does this end, the three-point explosion? How many more years in a row can we have that number go up before the game becomes homogenized or and it may already be past the point of no return for you.
It's already there. But I would say one thing about this entire conversation. I absolutely am not arguing that the players today are the most skilled players in the history of the sport. I mean, there's that. And also, I think you have to look at it another way, too, which is since we do, at least I certainly do, and I know you respect the history as well, you got to go look at the sport historically. If you go back and look at the game in the 1940s, you know, when it was the BAA before it turned into the NBA, the guys were shooting 29% from the field. I mean, I think that at 19, I remember correctly, I think, you had to wait until the 70s before you had teams shooting 50% from the field.
Yeah.
I think it was 77 or 78 was the first year. And so, you know, you go look at, you know, why were Russell and Chamberlain grabbing 25 rebounds a game? Because nobody could make a shot. Right. So it is cyclical. You went in the 40s and the 50s, you had guys shooting in the high 20s and the 30s. In the 50s, you got into the 40s all the way through the 50s. In the 60s and 70s, you slowly started to get a little bit higher. And now because you add the 3-point shot, you're going backwards a little bit into more misses, but you've got more effective shooting. So it really just depends on the it's a cyclical thing. I've heard people say, goodness, I would just love to see a preseason game with no threes just to force guys to make shots again. But then again, anybody who remembers, you know, the 90s, you just clog the middle and yeah. The game just clog. I mean, you know, go watch a basketball game from 1977. I mean, there's just no room. There's no room to do anything.
Yeah.
And so it's certainly not. The last thing I want to suggest is that I'm yelling at the clouds, because I'm not. It's just that you're watching something very, very different.
Yeah. No, eliminate the three and you're all of a sudden not going to have any more dunks either, because everyone's
just going to pack, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's going to open up the mid-range game. Well, no. It might, but yeah. It's, you know, guys are going to, you're just going to sit down and pack. And the players are too big for that.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I was thinking is that maybe, you know, and we've talked about this from the corner shots as well, maybe it's time that 94 by 50 is too small.
Yeah.
You know? And if the three, you know, I mean, how many, if the, and also the importance of the shot, right? The original conception of the 3-point shot was to give teams a chance to get back into games, right? That was the rationale early on, which is why you didn't have a whole lot of 3-point shots, right? It was a waste of a possession. You know, what would the three point attempt average be if the shot was 25 feet, if it was 30 feet? Would it change? But you can't have a 30-foot three because the court's not wide enough. You know, from the corners, you can't do that. The court's not big enough. So yeah. It is going to be interesting to see what they do with the shot. I think, where does it go? Clearly, we're already there, right? When you've got Utah as a one seed, half of their shots are 3-point attempts.
They also make them at a high rate too, though. So they're not one. They're not just a volume team. They've got a lot of. They've got shooters. They've got, as D'Antoni used to say, I need makers. They've got makers. Yeah. They're not just shooters. They're makers. And so it's at least not the most warped version of this that I think people fear the most, which is, oh, just go out there and jack up threes and all this and you can win. No. They've got guys who can shoot them.
But it's like the Celtics. I mean, the Celtics have guys shooting them who can't shoot them. Marcus Smart he's taking, 10 threes a game.
And without that spacing for the Jazz, you don't have Donovan Mitchell's acrobatics and all those incredible drives to the basket. You know, if you want Donovan Mitchell doing what he does and Ja Morant doing what he does and everybody else, like that's the modern game. So there's a great book on it for people who, if they haven't seen it yet, it's a couple of years old now. Kirk Goldsberry wrote Sprawl Ball, which examines all of this to incredible detail, but in a really accessible way too. But Kirk asks the question in very intelligent, smart ways about where is this leading and what does the NBA do? Are we at a crisis point? I think Kirk's conclusion is that we are, as you've said, Howard, that we're at a crisis point already, and that they need to start getting creative with it. But those are some tough discussions for the league. I don't know where that goes.
Well, that's why I love. I mean, that's why I still go back and people look at. You know, they're my two favorite teams of this modern era. Are obviously, you know, you're not really doing a whole lot to say it, but it's the, you know, Steph's Warriors and the Pop Spurs. Both of those teams led the league in 3-point and 2-point percentage. They were makers. They made shots, right? You know, you go watch, it wasn't like, you know, I used to call the Spurs basketball for grownups, right? Because they did all the modern stuff. They did all the throwback stuff while keeping the game modern. And then you look at the numbers, the reason was because the shot went in.
Yeah,
they made shots. They were 3-point leaders. They were 2-point leaders, and that's why I loved watching Kawhi in Game 7, where what you saw from him was just a guy who really, really, really went back to what, and he took 9 threes as well. But I mean, he's a mid-range marvel. He's a 60% shooter.
And I'll say this for all the people who, because you get this sometimes where people take it to the extreme. Oh, well, you know, they've devalued it so much that you don't have this anymore. You wouldn't have, you know, somebody puts up a Kobe highlight reel and say, nobody does this anymore. No. Devin Booker looks like move for move, inch for inch at times, like Kobe. Jason Tatum has plenty of it. Kawhi has plenty of it. Obviously, DeRozan. Like, there are plenty of really great mid-range shooters. It's just in today's NBA, you only want the best mid-range guys to take on the mid-range.
Yeah.
Right? And that's actually, on balance, a good thing. Again, I don't need crappy shooters trying to emulate Kobe moves from, 18 feet when they've got a 30% chance of it making it. If you want to take that out of the game, I'm fine with it.
However, I would like to say, speaking of Kawhi, I do want to say one quick thing.
Yeah.
And obviously you're far more plugged into this than I am, but I have been worried for the past couple of seasons that that Kawhi was kind of done. And when I would say done, I don't mean done as a player, obviously. I meant done as a LeBron-level superstar, best player in the game level, because I didn't think he was healthy. I was like, there's something about him when you watch his lift. I was like, okay, are we going to be looking at Kawhi Leonard as a guy who left everything out there to get Toronto a championship and he was never the same player? Really wondered about that. But boy, watching him against Dallas made me think that maybe he's healthy again. He was moving really, really well, and he had lift. Yeah. He was doing that Kawhi stuff again, and I was like, this is exciting to see.
Especially the last couple of games, especially when it was time to rally that team and knock the Mavericks out. We saw that. It's been suggested to me, because people like to mock load management, especially Kawhi Leonard being almost the poster boy for it now, but that it's been suggested to me that what happened in San Antonio, and I can't remember the nature of that injury, but what happened in San Antonio, the thing that put the divide between him and the Spurs in the first place and caused the trade to Toronto where he wins the championship and all the load management that Toronto did, it's been suggested to me that that injury, it's not just that they were trying to injury manage in the wake of it. It was, no, this is how it has to be done for the rest of his career because of the nature of that injury. And so when he's getting load managed by the Clippers, when we're seeing, or you're observing at times, maybe he's not the guy anymore. Maybe he's lost a little bit. I'm just speculating, but I think it may all lead back to that injury and the fact that, as I say, it's something that has been, that was suggested to me. It's something that will be with him for the rest of his career on some level. And so maybe on the nights that we're not seeing him at that LeBron level or near LeBron, no, what's that, LeBron's level, but the level where people were suggesting, maybe Kawhi's now the best in the league if LeBron's falling off. If you don't see that guy every night, maybe it's because of that.
Yeah.
I
don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think that this is, I'm having this argument right now because I'm finishing a biography on Ricky Henderson.
Which I can't wait for, by the way.
And everybody, I can't wait till it's done. And everybody's talking about, The game changes. Like when Ricky was coming up, you had to play 150 games. I just got off the phone with John Shea before we did this, the great writer over in San Francisco. And, he was talking about how, and he just did his Willie Mays book, Willie played 150 games, 13 straight years. And most of those years was in a 154 game season. He missed 21 games in 10 years. Right. But times change. Times change now. And I've been asking the question for years, do you even need an 82-game season anymore? Right? I mean, all of these different questions, you have to at least be willing to ask the question. I remember when we were coming up, you had 23 teams and 16 of them made the playoffs. Right? I mean, I still feel like that 50-game season in 99 was pretty damn competitive. I mean, it wasn't a bad number.
Yeah, the 66-game season and the second lockout season, the 11-12 season, was probably closer to, I think, what people think the ideal would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, it's more of a financial consideration than anything else now. I mean, I think everybody would agree that for the sake of higher quality basketball, player health, fan interest, having every game feel more meaningful, everybody agrees fewer games would be better. The only count in which it's not better is the one that's the most important, which is revenue.
The money, sure, 100%.
So
100%. We have that argument now in baseball. People talk about, it's time to go back to 154, especially because with the new stadiums and everything being what they are, because the retractable roofs aren't mandatory. How can you do this? How can you add, how can you add another layer of playoffs and not end up having, Cleveland and the Cubs playing in the snow in the World Series? Baseball, at some point, the weather becomes the factor. But then, of course, the argument is, the owners will never, ever, ever give away that many home dates. Do you know how much money you actually lose if you wipe out a week of the season? The money is, it's overwhelming. So you have to pay attention to those financial considerations.
Yeah. That, again, that one's right up there with the, should they redesign the NBA court, make it bigger, and what do we do about too many threes? Like, it's...
Yeah. These 72 is a pretty good number, though. I mean, I think you're right. I think maybe a little fewer, 66 is good. But I didn't miss these 10 games. And
you know what?
And I don't mind. I didn't mind the little play-in, even though I thought at first I would. It didn't bother me.
No, I liked the play-in. I liked the fact that it induced teams to actually try down the stretch, teams that would have otherwise pulled the plug. And... yeah, 72, like the end of the season crept up really quick on us, but that's actually a good thing because you feel the urgency as a fan, as a media person, as the NBA teams themselves. You have, of course, written a lot in your career and in several of your books about intersection between, you know, sports and society, politics, race. We hit, what was it, 2 weeks ago, I think now, the 1 year anniversary of George Floyd's killing. And which means we are in the midst now of an ongoing 1 year anniversary, which will continue for months, of the explosion of athlete activism, especially within the NBA. Last summer in the bubble, of course, Black Lives Matter was written straight on the courts. Everybody was kneeling for the national anthem, including referees. And we had messages on the backs of uniforms, all these things. And I think all along the way, it was this interesting moment, you know, the Wildcat strike in the midst of the bubble, all of it. And it was, well, how long will this last? And where will this go? And teams are pledging to do certain things, pledging money, pledging to be better on these issues, all of this stuff that goes in the wake of it. And it felt like a moment. And it felt bigger than a moment. It felt like, you know, maybe even a turning point for not just sports, but society at large. We are here a year later. And, of course, the NBA looks more or less like it did before. No slogans on the courts. No one's kneeling. There are players still speaking out. I think a lot of the guys who found their voices are still using those voices. But it's not where it was a year ago because the urgency maybe of that moment has passed a little. And so I wanted to throw this to you because I know, you know, this is obviously issues that you have explored deeply and extensively. How should we view this a year later? Was there progress made or not? Does the fact that it's not as present mean that it's fallen by the wayside? Does the hope or optimism that it inspired that we're all ready, including those of us who are white America, to grapple with these issues, the fact that it has seemingly faded from view, what do we make of that today?
Yeah, it's great. Well, I can tell you just as a basketball watcher, I just miss education reform fouling love us, right? I mean, I kind of miss that, you know? Education reform was my favorite slogan on the back of my head. What does this have to do with it?
There were some obscure ones. There were some obscure ones. There were some that were...
I'm all for it, but yeah. Look, I mean, I don't want to make light of this at all. I mean, I kind of do a little bit. But I think that, number one, I think that the moment versus movement question was always a real one. I think it had always been to me the question of the athletes were going to find out the limits of what they could do, that this entire idea of concierge service activism was going to fall on its face a little bit, that the players can only do so much in the first place. And what are they actually truly committed to doing? I mean, to me, the entire piece of this movement that had long-term value was their citizenship, was being a citizen, and that didn't necessarily have to be out front. It had to be, okay, is this going to make you a more involved citizen? I never believed for a minute that the leagues themselves were going to be allies to this because the league is essentially protesting itself, right? I mean, at some point, and the players at some point are protesting themselves. At some point, when does the protester become the power? I mean, when you start looking at the LeBron Jameses of the world and the Steph Currys and where these guys are at in terms of all of their deals with State Farm and T-Mobile and this, you're part of this machine. You may be trying to fix pieces of the machine, but you're not trying to overthrow the machine. You're not trying to reinvent the machine. You're still in a position of asking. You're asking this apparatus to do better by your people. And whenever you're in a position of asking, you're always in a spot where they can say no. And I think that some of the players got slapped in the face really hard. It was like a bucket of water on them, especially, you know, especially the Bucks, when guys were talking about, you know, using the arenas as voting stations. And then, you know, the Milwaukee legislature reneged on a lot of those promises. Some of that stuff just didn't happen. I think that the players got slapped in the face the same way the rest of the country got slapped in the face on January 6th, right? I mean, the entire league for the last, you know, during post-Ferguson, Kaepernick years, all of this, we're all told that, you know, this was not the way to behave and that you had to act a certain way and that you couldn't protest. And then you look at what happened there. And I always thought, okay, well, what are the players going to do about that? You know, that you were told when, you know, during this Wildcat strike, you know, Barack Obama went out and told the players, go back to work, told the players to invest in the voting process, invest in the system, invest in the machine working. And then on January 6th, you saw people go out and fought specifically the machine. And in Georgia, they fought specifically against voting. And on January 6th, they fought specifically against all of the things that the players were told to invest in. And the players have been silent since. So maybe the players realized, hey, well, we did our best and now it's time to go back and make our money. Or they felt like, you know, it was a moment and not a movement. I don't know what the answer is on that. I do know that if I'm LeBron James, I wonder very deeply how I feel about this country, where everybody told me to invest in the system working and I go out and create voting initiatives and I am faced. And when I say slapped in the face, specifically slapped in the face by all of the anti-voting access legislation that has followed this moment. So you now have to decide who you're going to be living in this country. And I think that the players in some ways, and maybe not the WNBA, but I think in some ways, I don't want to say they've been cowed, because I don't think cowed is the right word, but I think they've refocused on their profession. And maybe that's even a good thing in some ways, because one of the things that I've been asking is, how much do we expect them to do anyway? Yeah. Right? I mean, did they do their job on this, which was to be a presence, which was to be visible, which was to show that they were paying attention? Did we really expect a $10 billion industry to have Black Lives Matter on the basketball court forever? I mean, if we really look at the NBA as an industry, if you take the labor away from it, it's just as white as IBM or Apple or anybody else.
True.
Right? I mean, the only black thing about the NBA is the players. And so I didn't have a great deal of optimism that this was going to create some great new day, because there's far too much of the apparatus that supports the very initiatives that run counter to what the players were fighting. You know, and it will be real interesting in seeing how both the NFL, as we saw with the Sam Darnold news when it came to the vaccinations, and we've seen some of the other players talk about it with vaccination, all of this stuff is politicized. So you're, in some ways, when you're fighting about values, you really, at some point, as a league, are going to have to create a new strategy. Like, for example, are you going to have these dueling slogans? Like, are you, like, when fans come back, are you going to have, you know, Black Lives Matter on the court on the same night as, you know, Law Enforcement Appreciation Night? These two concepts run in direct opposition of each other, right? I mean, so all of this stuff has to be confronted in a certain way, or we're just going to be sloganeering and having dueling slogans every night in sports arenas across the country. So I always felt that there was a finite level of the sort of the public sloganeering of it, because it just, at some point, it was incongruous. But it will be interesting to see what the players do as citizens. I think that's the best place to sort of see what they do and what they become.
No, I think that's right. I think that expecting a mass movement within sports or within any given league to continue as an ongoing matter, I mean, first of all, I'm sure it's exhausting trying to carry on your professional athletic career.
You still have a job.
Right. And at the same time, be a full-time activist. Like, it's not realistic. And part of what enabled so many guys to take to the streets and write op-eds and do a ton of media appearances, and I'm talking about the players specifically, Malcolm Brogdon, Jaylen Brown, and so many others, is that we were still in lockdown at that time, and there wasn't, you know, they weren't in the midst of their season. They hadn't gone to the bubble yet.
Well, most of the players aren't activists anyway. I mean, I am a very, very strict conservative guy on that issue when it comes to words. To me, an activist is somebody who's in the streets. I think that what a lot of these guys are, I don't really consider LeBron James an activist. I consider LeBron James to be an extremely, extremely influential person who stands on the right side of issues. I don't see LeBron James outside. I don't see him out there doing what activists do. And so I don't, I put him in a separate, he's in a different category.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would say this, Howard. So I think the things that were repeatable or sustainable that came out of last year. Broadly, if guys found their voice for the first time, because a lot of players spoke out who we'd never heard speak to these issues before. And so I think a lot of guys found at that time their voice in a way that I think was empowering and inspired some confidence that I can do this again.
Yeah.
So I think that part sustains, that if anything happens tomorrow, next week, that rises to the level of the George Floyd or Breonna Taylor incidents or anything, you know, anything that moves them, players are going to feel more comfortable because the norm has been reset. The bar has been set at a different spot.
That's right. And the NBA is a test case anyway, because as we talk about all of these things, whether we're talking about Naomi Osaka or whether we're talking about team sports, right? The real question for everything at all comes back down to labor. And in the NBA is the one that's out front on this question about, are we employees or are we partners? Are we partners or do we work for you? And so this is really the gigantic paradigm shift. And when you're partners, then when something goes down that's important to you, you get a say on it. If you're an employee, then you got to ask permission and negotiate and hope that they let you put education reform on the back of your jerseys. You know, this is the difference, right? And so the NFL is completely unambiguous. You are employees. The NBA, there's been always more wiggle room to conform to the people who play the sport.
Yeah.
Major League Baseball, you are employees, and also Major League Baseball, the politics of that sport is so different that you don't have consensus anyway. So that's why I go back to citizenship. That's why the Jaylen Browns of the world. Jaylen Brown is probably the you know, one of my favorite guys in the league for that very reason. He's a citizen. He's paying attention to what is happening in this country and where he stands and what his values are. And he's not going to allow his profession to make him think lesser about those things. And I think that the real connection, Howard, what we're really sort of talking about, where I see it in the NBA, is I see it in the increased vigilance of the players in how they react to how the paying customer treats them. I think they are very much taking strong position that you will not treat us this way, that you do not have the right to do whatever you want when just because you bought a ticket. And I think that's the area to me where you run into this sort of last stand, resentments. I still say, people say, you know, and I heard Kevin Durant's feelings as well, talking about how this is a difficult time in terms of where the country is. People are coming out of lockdown. This is a real mental health issue as well in terms of, you know, our kids are failing out of schools. They haven't, you know, my son hasn't been in a classroom since the 10th grade. You know, do we shake hands when we go out? Do we go out at all? When we go to restaurants, or, you know, are we expecting our servers to wear masks? What about the guy sitting next to us? Is he vaxxed or is he not? I mean, this is a wild moment that we're in. And let's also not forget, whenever things happen, there's always going to be a backlash. And you do have the paying customer who may have been extremely angry at the fact that Black Lives Matter was on the court, that they're acting out, that this is payback as well for a year that made them very, very uncomfortable, especially as everything is as politicized as it is. So it's important to pay attention to all of these different dots and seeing what happens with them and to seeing how they connect. Because I have no doubt in my mind they absolutely connect.
I have no doubt about that either. I think the one thing that's striking to me, and I still don't know the answer to this, I disagree with Durant that what we've seen in this rash of whatever it was, like five fan incidents in a week or whatever it was, in all different arenas, different fan bases, I think all white fans probably, so there we go to your point. But attributing it to lockdown and coming out of lockdown as if people have forgotten how to act in a semi-civilized society, I don't buy that part. People have not...
You think it's being too kind?
I don't think people have been truly locked down. I think we've all still maintained some level of social lives. And just the idea that you go back into an arena with 20,000 other people and suddenly you've lost all control and you're throwing bottles and you're throwing out.
No, I think it's payback. And I think that the Kevin Durants of the world, and this goes back to our conversation, they are not necessarily in the position or want to be in the position to say, here's what I really think it is.
Yeah.
Right. I think you're paying us back for what happened last year. And I think that you've decided that it's okay to do that. Because we've all gotten away with it, right? Everybody gets away with everything now, right? So maybe there's a piece of that. I also think there's another thing involved here too that at least, you know, should be discussed a little bit. And that is the fact that when you deal with the players, right, that the players in the NBA have made it very, very clear that they view themselves as partners. And that... just from the standpoint of where we are, the way people deal with labor, the way we treat labor, the way we don't want people to be empowered, there's a backlash to that too. There's a real backlash to that. And, you know, that whole shut up and play thing is not a small thing. And once again, I am very interested in seeing what the leagues do. Whatever, you know, I was thinking about this, and I hate to cut my own self off on that, but it really did make me think about when this Naomi Osaka stuff was happening in tennis, and let's not forget that she and the Milwaukee Bucks were the ones who sort of began this wildcat strike last year. It all, to me, reminds me of Donald Sterling. It always comes back to Donald Sterling when you listen to him on that tape and he says, who runs the game? Do I make the game or do they make the game? Yeah. And that is the battle that's taking place right now. And the players are trying to say, we make the game. And so once again, I always just go back to Donald Fear. It's like, you know, the game is owners versus players. The game is not Red Sox Yankees. It always comes back to labor.
Yeah. Well, this it's funny because I kind of highlighted this off to the side on my computer here because I want to touch on it. We don't have to go deep into it, but I'll just touch on it as another data point on this. But the quote from the anonymous NBA GM speaking to the New Yorker for the feature on Rich Paul, LeBron's agent.
Yep.
And the anonymous GM says, quote, player empowerment is a catch-all for the fact that the league has done a terrible job of empowering teams. The players have all of the leverage in every situation. I think it's the worst thing that ever happened to professional sports on all levels. And like that says so much.
It sure does. Well, the reserve clause is the worst thing that ever happened to professional sports. I mean, segregation. Let's be clear about
the,
that.
The if inverse taking, of what we're talking about.
Exactly. If we're making a list of the worst things in sports, I think that's probably there. However, let me say this. This is part of the battle, right? I mean, I remember reading that story and I was like, okay, the one piece of that has always been concerning to me has been what happens when your teams no longer carry any true value, right? Like, you know, you and I talked about this in the last pod we did in New York. You know, my Spear of Lightning theory, right? You've got to have somebody in the player position represent the coach and the team. You know, Pop had it with Duncan and Tony Parker and Ginobili and, you know, Phil Jackson had it with Michael, but those guys still had that old school thing that the team still mattered as well.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, like, when I think about my nefarious supervillain attitudes, I mean, I honestly believe that the paradigm shift of, you know, the true legacy of LeBron James is not going to be going to the finals 8 years in a row. It's going to be the fact that the devaluing of both the team and the front office and the coach is really where he comes from. I mean, that is, when I think about the LeBron James era, LeBron James does not follow the Spear of Lightning theory. I mean, name me a coach that LeBron sort of pumped up and repped in the foot. He didn't rep Paul Silas. He didn't rep Tyrone or David Blatt or any of them. Mike Brown. He didn't do any of that to any of those guys, right? He's the coach. When you listen to Kyrie Irving talked about Steve Nash. He's a Hall of Famer. He's just sort of an advisor.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so you really are moving into a sort of different era in that coach-player relationship. And the coach-player relationship, of course, is going to, you know, it translates also into, you know, free agency and everything else. Like, what are you going to do if you are the Indiana Pacers? I mean, you were already up against it in terms of attracting free agents. What are you going to do? Even the Boston Celtics, you know, guys don't want to come play for you. I mean, so what does happen to the future of the sport if the teams themselves have lost virtually all of their leverage, right? I mean, seriously, what happens?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, when this next CBA comes up for the NBA in a few years, I'll be curious to see if they actually even try to tackle that. Because I think if they try
to... How do you tackle that?
You can't. And if they try to, it's going to backfire even more spectacularly than the last few times that they've attempted anything along those lines.
That's right. Well, they tried it with money. They tried it with money before. They tried it with, okay, first the Larry Bird thing where, you know...
But that worked for decades.
It did work, exactly. Now it's like, okay... Well, now they've got the Supermax contract where your team, you know, gets to offer you the most money to sort of keeping you to stay. But, you know, even that doesn't really work. So when you start talking about marquee franchises, I mean, how many places are actual destinations? I honestly believe, I don't remember who said it, but I think it was Bomani when we were talking that the NBA has a real estate problem.
Yes, that was Bomani's quote. Yeah.
Yeah. This is one of those examples where you may have too many teams, right? I mean,
and in the wrong places potentially.
And in the wrong places. Like, I was watching tennis yesterday. I'm watching the Nadal match, and I'm looking at this, and I'm going, you know, for the most part, okay, we're at the semifinals now. You've got a draw of 128 players, and now, whereas there is always suspense when you step on a court, you can lose, right? There's the inherent suspense in that. It's not really true. And so, if you have so, you know, it's like. So is everybody just the Washington Generals for Nadal and Djokovic? Is everyone the Washington Generals for whatever team LeBron and Kevin Durant play for? I mean, if that is the case, and it's always been the case in the NBA when you really think about it, because the NBA is a best player wins league.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it always has been. The best players in the NBA win. That's it. There's nothing you can do about that. The question is, what do you do when it's reached a sort of untenable point? But I don't think that it has reached an untenable point in terms of competition, because look at who's playing right now. You're going to have, I think you've got six teams who could win a championship for the first time.
Yes. Yes. And the field is so just strange right now that you could take any pairing right now of East and West. And I'd believe that that's possibly what we'll see. Like, there is not, yep. I mean, aside from unlikely that it'll be the Hawks, but three teams in the East and four in the West are all plausible, which I would say on balance is a good thing.
That's right.
But anyway, I know you got some family obligations you got to go, but before I let you hop off, so for the listeners and for me, tell me what you're doing with Meadowlark, with Dan Lebatard's new media project.
Yes,
and your Ricky mm-hmm. Henderson book that's coming.
Yes, well, I've joined the pirate ship. It's been phenomenal. I've been there a couple of
do you
weeks.
Get a, do you get an eye patch with that? Comes with the pirate ship? Swords?
I have not gotten I don't even have a parrot. They didn't give me a bird to put on my shoulder. I got nothing right now. I think Dan should have some. I think we should get pirate ship gear.
For sure. Yes. And a parrot.
And I think
everybody should have a parrot.
Exactly. And I think you and I should do some sort of cultural exchange where you can throw me some Bleacher Report old school and I'll get you some pirate ship gear.
Eventually I'll get some SI gear and maybe I can get you some of that too, if I ever get any.
SI gear. No, I'm going to be doing some development. I'm certainly going to be doing some documentary development, some film development. I'm still doing writing. I'm going to do some, you know, dozen columns a year for ESPN, but the Meadowlark stuff is going to be all working on film. It's going to be film docs trying to continue to tell stories in a different medium. I mean, this is sort of where the business is going in a lot of ways too. I mean, we love our words, we love our writing, and the writing and the books and all of that, the IP still, you know, the intellectual property of that is still the baseline of almost everything that we watch. So it's just going to be a fun opportunity trying to develop more stories that I think people would like to see. As for Ricky, yeah, Ricky is Ricky, the life and legend of an American original. One of my I think it's my favorite. Obviously, every book you work on at that time is your favorite. But it's been phenomenal just following his arc and just, you know, people talk about how bland and how vanilla baseball is right now. Not Ricky. Ricky's just phenomenal. I mean, he's just great. The stories are great. The book itself has just been so much fun to sort of research. Going back into the 80s, I was talking to someone the other day. Who was I talking to? I was talking to Jimmy Rollins, used to play for the Phillies, and an Oakland guy as well. And I said to him, it's fascinating to me that people were giving Ricky more grief for going to arbitration for $900,000 than they are for, you know, Trevor Bauer making $40 million today. It's just, it was a different time. I love digging back into the history.
I can't wait for that one. As you know, I'm a Bay Area guy. I grew up in San Jose. I was an A's fan during that era. So Ricky might've been my first favorite ball player that I could think of because I loved speed. I love guys who could just flat out sprint. And the stolen base is just something that it has its own brand of excitement attached to it. It's unique. It's a thing unto itself. And I love Ricky. I can still remember, like, I think the year he set the record, the San Jose Mercury News, my hometown paper, which I believe you had a time at. A quality time. But I can remember like a cover story one year, maybe it was the spring training issue, whatever. It was like dissecting like Ricky's stolen base or whatever. Like there's a whole cover story with graphics and everything like that's ingrained in my head. So cannot wait for the book.
I love the personalities, especially Ricky and Billy Martin.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
Yes. We need more Rickies. We need more Billy Martins. We need the biggest personalities in sports. Too many brand managers and PR people getting everybody to be bland these days.
No, that's for certain.
You got other stuff to do. I got to let you go. But this has been great, man. Hope to get you back again soon. Can't wait to see what you're doing with Meadowlark.
Indeed. Well, you know the deal. Harry, call anytime.
Will do. Thanks, HB.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.